This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning, we're diving into something that affects 1 in 3 Americans, but still leaves so many of us confused: allergies. Our guest this morning is Dr. Zachary Rubin, a double board-certified pediatrician specializing in allergy treatment and immunology, and a viral social media sensation known for delivering clear, science-driven answers about how our immune systems really work.
Dr. Rubin joins us to explore his new book, just out. It's called All About Allergies, Everything You Need to Know About Asthma, Food Allergies, Hay Fever, and More. From why hypoallergenic doesn't always mean safe to how asthma, eczema, and hay fever are all part of the same allergy puzzle. This conversation couldn't come at a better time now that it's spring here in the Wasatch. Spring is coming, and so are the sniffles. Dr. Zachary Rubin, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, who would know that someone like you would have 4 million followers on social media? I would like to say it's because allergies affect so many of us, but I have an idea that it has more to do with your magnetic personality and what your content is. Tell us a little bit about that.
Thank you so much. Yeah. So this started, like for many people on social media, at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. I had moved from St. Louis to the Chicagoland area and everything was shut down. So as a specialist, it's very hard to connect with people. And so I went to social media, met a lot of great people online, healthcare workers, patients, et cetera. But I also saw so much misinformation, a lot of incorrect facts about COVID-19, food allergies, asthma, or other health-related issues, because anybody could have a platform online and anybody could appear to have some type of expertise. And so I decided to create educational content that slowly but surely connected with a lot of people, where I'm taking complicated concepts, distilling it down to what makes it easily understandable, but with nuance and clarity that's evidence-based. And along the way, I sprinkle some humor in and a little bit of hula hooping to dance around and have some fun and show that doctors are not just on an ivory tower, that we're all human and can be dorky too.
And you do mean that literally, hula hooping, because I saw you. So that's great. You know, it sounds like a bit of a naive question, but what really is happening in our bodies physiologically when we are having an allergy/immune response?
Right. So that's a very general question about the field of allergy, which literally means an abnormal immune system response to foreign substances. And we can really dive down into all the different mechanisms by which your immune system, which is normally meant to protect you from the outside world, could think that something as harmless as pet dander could be potentially life-threatening, or even food that's meant to sustain us could actually end some people's lives, right? It can make people very sick. And so there are different ways that the immune system can do this. But the classic way is called a type 1 hypersensitivity, where you make these proteins that are little tags called IgE, which are normally meant to protect against parasitic infections, which you see if you are swimming in a pond, as an example. They can make these antibodies towards food or pollen. And right now, as springtime is upon us, tree pollen is coming out in full force. And that causes our immune system to release many chemicals like histamine in the immediate phase, leading to itching, runny nose, stuffy nose, potentially coughing. And as that keeps going, more of your immune system is recruited to create more swelling in your nasal cavities, where you're really congested, or you get post-nasal drip. And it can make it hard to breathe, which makes it hard to sleep and focus and do well at work or school, and increases your risk of having secondary infections like in your ear, in your sinuses, or if you have asthma, potentially pneumonia.
Could you, for the listeners, help us understand the difference between some terms that are thrown around a lot, like allergy, intolerance, sensitivity? You know, some of those things that they might hear but might be interpreting incorrectly.
Right. So the terminology matters because it'll tell us a lot about what's going on and what do we do to manage these issues. So again, if you have an allergy, that's an abnormal immune system response. And depending on the substance that it's reacting to, you could have milder symptoms or potentially life-threatening symptoms, like with food allergies, as an example. If you are allergic to peanut butter and you eat it and you're allergic, you could have mild itching or hives, maybe even swelling, or it could be severe with problems breathing, like wheezing, tongue swelling, throat swelling, severe vomiting, or a combination of these symptoms. And in rare cases, can progress towards something called anaphylactic shock, where the blood pressure drops, and that could have blood go away from vital organs like your heart, brain, which in, again, rare situations can lead to heart attack, stroke, and even death. That's different than an intolerance to food, which is more of a digestive problem, where it's harder to break down the food in your gut, and so your bacteria in your gut will take that up and create gas that leads to abdominal pain, bloating, diarrhea, and is not life-threatening. You could generally tolerate a much higher dose of that compared to if you have an allergy. And there's not a lot of testing we can do to verify other than clinically recognize that that exists. And then sensitivity is more of a non-specific term where people will ascribe certain symptoms like headaches, fatigue, joint pain after eating certain foods. And it's not to say that it's not real. It's just that we don't understand the mechanism by which that could happen. Therefore, we don't really have testing to verify it. Again, clinically, if somebody really feels that there is a clear relationship between something like gluten, as an example, where they eat it and they develop these symptoms, then they remove that food for a few weeks and the symptoms go away and then they add it back in and have it again, then there might be some type of sensitivity there, but it's hard to guide people because there's really no reliable testing.
Yeah. And gluten is a good example. I'm gluten-free for about 20 years now, but I have a sister and a brother who have ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. So there's definitely some sensitivity in my family, but I didn't actually have that. My response with my body was I was exhausted and I had nasal stuff. And like, it was really bizarre. It wasn't related to the GI tract at all. And so I'm wondering, in the last 20 years, we've seen a humongous explosion of gluten sensitivity from people, and whether that's them deciding that they'd like to stay away from it, which is very fair, or whether it's an actual intolerance. What do you think is, or what are the leading theories amongst allergists about why so many people seem to be developing more allergies? Or is that even true?
So more people are developing allergies to the environment and to food. This has been ongoing for the past 20 to 30 years. And we know it's not one issue. There's no magic bullet that if we take this away or fix this one problem, that all this will go away. The closest thing that we've had so far where there's really good evidence for it is the timing of introducing these foods to kids. That if you delay it, you increase the risk of them developing allergy to it because you are moving away from the ability for the immune system to tolerate that food earlier in life. And so with the changes in recommendations over the past 10 years, we're starting to see a slow decline in some of the foods, specifically peanut, which used to be the most common food that babies were allergic to, but now it's egg. So it's lagged a little bit from from those recommendations. But there's a lot of associations where you look at large population data sets and you try to find, is there a common factor? It's not necessarily causative yet, but as an example, we're looking into the gut microbiome. This is the environment of the bacteria that are in your gut that can help process foods. And so we know that antibiotics can change the gut microbiome. You're not only just killing the bad bacteria causing the infection, but you're killing good bacteria. And we see an association between early antibiotic use and people developing food allergies later on. A similar association with antacids used to treat reflux in babies is also there. Or babies born via C-section, they don't get exposed to the bacterial flora in the birth canal. And again, there's an association, not causative. There's no definitive study that really says this is the one reason. And so there's a multiple of factors in that way. Vitamin D might play a role as well, and potentially how we process foods. But the number of reasons this could be is numerous, likely a combination of genetics and environment that we are still trying to figure out right now.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. Zachary Rubin. He's talking to us about his new book, all about allergies. Okay, Dr. Rubin. So while you know, gut flora and microbiome and all of that may be a contributing factor to the increase in allergies among people. So is our education, our level of education. I mean, my kids are, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and I knew even when they were babies, you don't want to put them on antibiotics unless you absolutely have to. We've been talking about microbiome for at least that long. Are you seeing now a difference among patients, because you are so immersed in this world, between those who are really addressing their gut microbiome and those who are just kind of blowing it off in terms of allergies?
Well, in terms of using the gut microbiome as a treatment for allergic diseases, there's still so much that we have to do to understand what we do with it. This is more of an issue of, can we prevent, with altering the gut microbiome, can we prevent these things from happening? So these aren't really a lot of the conversations I have with my patients, where if they've already had asthma, food allergies, or hay fever, they're not using pro or prebiotics to try to treat it because there really is no evidence that it helps at this point, unfortunately. But there is going to be something, most likely, I hypothesize, that if we intervene early enough in life, we may be able to prevent some of these issues. But the relationships are still a lot of data points that we have to look at, and it's still a while away before we can really understand what type of bacteria do we really need to use, what's the dose, all of these different factors to be able to give the best recommendation on this.
Okay. So I am someone who has developed asthma sort of late in life, although I've had two siblings who've had really quite bad asthma their entire lives. I've been thinking that it's related to food, but I don't really know how to test that. And I've heard different people say, well, gosh, I cut out red meat and then I didn't have asthma anymore. In your book, do you offer up ways to sort of go through these tests on yourself to figure out what you respond to better or don't respond to?
In terms of asthma, I have an entire chapter where I talk about it, and we look at the molecular mechanisms for asthma, because it's not really one disease. There's different ways your immune system can abnormally respond to the world and cause symptoms of coughing, wheezing, shortness of breath, chest tightness, and/or difficulty breathing, which in some cases can be potentially life-threatening. And so we talk about all these different triggers like exercise, cold air, changes in weather, environmental allergens like pollen or pollutants. We talk about some of the wildfire smoke that was coming from Canada over the past few summers that could lead to asthma attacks. The role of diet in asthma, for most people, unless you have a true food allergy, there's not really a clear link between I eat meat and this is causing my asthma symptoms, unless we're able to identify allergy antibodies that can specifically bind to the food. But by understanding the molecular mechanisms of asthma, we can then have even more targeted therapies. So we talk about a whole class of medications called biologics, which many people are not aware of, that can help with more severe asthmatics to just finally tune down the immune system to be less reactive to these foreign substances in the lungs, to help them breathe a lot easier and reduce the risk of having severe asthma attacks.
Wow. In that direction, here in a mountain town, we have a lot of people who like to live a natural lifestyle or as natural as possible. And they're every time of year, the spring rolls around and we hear a little bit about local honey or probiotics or quercetin or things we can take before the trees all bud out that might help our allergy response for the season ahead. Is there any credence to that?
Unfortunately, when it comes to local honey, it's not effective for treating allergies, other than if you have a sore throat or cough and you're 12 months or older. You can't give it to babies because there's a risk of botulinum toxin. And so the issue is that there is pollen in the honey, but it's not the pollen you're allergic to. It's pollen coming from insect-pollinated plants. As an example, if you sneeze when you smell roses, it's not the pollen that you're sneezing from, it's the fragrance. And so when you have a tree pollen allergy, it's going to be to these trees that release millions of pollen grains every season that you're exposed to from miles away. And it's a consistent exposure. This is to like birch tree or ragweed pollen. And so that's not the pollen found in local honey. If anybody reports having improvements in symptoms, again, it's going to be the sore throat and cough because it's just a natural suppressant for that, but it's not going to effectively treat it like an allergy injection where we're actually giving you the substance that you're allergic to in a controlled manner. There are supplements like quercetin, like you had mentioned, that have some antihistaminic properties, but they're not well regulated by the FDA. So you don't know if you're getting the exact dose that's on the bottle. And we don't know the exact dose that is effective, nor do we really have a good understanding of its safety long term. So I always say people can certainly use it, but you have to understand those potential risks when using something like that. The most natural way to treat allergies, if people are looking into that, is reducing exposure to those allergens if you know what you're allergic to, but also every night rinsing your nasal passages with a neti pot or saline rinse bottle using distilled water and making a saline mixture, which you can either go online and find the mixture or just get packets if you don't have the time. That rinses away the irritants, allergens, pollutants, and mucus that's clogging up your nasal passages. So not only do you breathe easier at night, but if you choose to use medicine in your nose, it's more effective. And there's even evidence to suggest that if you have a cold, it may decrease the duration of that cold by potentially a day or two in some cases.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the neti pot. I'm a singer, and so and my brother's a singer in Nashville, and it's just a part of professional musicians' lifestyle because it does keep things much clearer. But word to the wise, do not do it without the proper salt to water ratio, or you will experience a headache like nothing you've ever known in your life. It is very painful.
Oh yeah. Or it burns.
It just burns. Yes. It feels like just like a terrible ice cream headache burn. So definitely follow the directions. Let me ask you this. We talk a lot about preventing and treating allergies, but are there any cures? Is anything on the horizon that looks like it actually may cure them?
So unfortunately, at this time, there's not really definitive cures for most allergic diseases. There is some gene therapy that's being used for a rare type of condition called hereditary angioedema, where there's a genetic defect that causes your body to have swelling attacks. And so by correcting that gene defect, you could potentially cure that. But that's not the case for the majority of people with allergic diseases. So we have much better ways to manage them. There's a lot of good research, which I talk about at the end of my book, with all the different diseases. We look at what is some of the hot topics in research at the time that I wrote the book. And there's one interesting study that's ongoing right now for food allergies, where they're taking two approved medications, one to treat severe eczema and other allergic diseases called dupilumab, and another one that treats a cancer that's of the plasma cells in your immune system called multiple myeloma. It's called linvoseltamab. And so using those two together might be able to knock out the chain of events that lead to the production of those allergy antibodies. So could that be potentially curative? Maybe, but with a lot of things that we hear about in research, it takes time to do them. You need multiple studies and that they're replicable and in large groups of people. And along the way, you may end up seeing a safety signal that it's not safe to do this, or it's not as effective as we thought it was. But on the surface, something like that sounds very interesting and potentially promising, but there's no guarantees.
Wow, that's really interesting. You know, a couple months ago, probably a couple years ago, now that I say it that way, we interviewed someone about some advances in type of immunotherapy for peanut allergies, which, you know, if we're talking about the most grave allergies out there, there's probably peanut and, you know, if you get stung by a bee and go into anaphylactic shock, which is really interesting. I'm sure you've got others, but those are the ones that come to my mind. That I think is some sort of medication where they expose you to tiny, tiny amounts of peanut. Is that actually immunotherapy? And how is that working?
Right. So there is immunotherapy for food allergens. It's called OIT, or oral immunotherapy. It's something I do in my clinic. And we essentially, kind of like allergy shots, we're giving daily doses that are by mouth, slow but incremental doses of whatever it is, like peanut protein. And over time, over several months, we build up their ability to tolerate peanuts to the point that they could eat, in my clinic, three peanuts a day. And what that does is it helps reduce the chances of having a reaction if there's accidental exposure. It's not a guarantee that they can tolerate as much as they want or freely eat it. Some may be able to do that, but not all. And so this is very promising for many individuals who have multiple food allergies. I don't think it's beneficial for everybody because there's side effects and you have certain lifestyle changes that you have to do. But I think it could be very helpful for the right situation. There's now even an FDA-approved medication that achieves it fairly similarly. It's called omalizumab, known as Xolair, as an injectable medicine that blocks those allergy antibodies to, again, give you that protective coat, but no guarantee that it's going to cure it.
I believe you started out as a pediatrician, and now you're kind of in this whole allergy zone. Why did you find it so interesting?
Well, so after doing my pediatrics training, I felt that I really wanted to make sure I could keep as many people out of the hospital as possible and look at different specialties that do this. And when I spent some time in allergy, I was immediately drawn to it because of a few issues. One is the fact that it's exploding in its knowledge, that over the past 10 to 20 years, all these new medications, our understanding of the world is very different. And so it's constantly feeling new and fresh to me that I'm learning all the time from my patients and from the medical literature and the scientists. So it makes every day very interesting. I also realize as a pediatrician, when my patients grow up, I lose them. But in allergy, you could be a pediatrician and take care of adults, or you could be an internist taking care of adults and then take care of children. I take care of whole families now. So I build these beautiful relationships with my patients and their families where I'm taking care of 4, 5, 6 plus members of the same family and their cousins. And I'm in a small private practice in the suburbs of Chicago, actually where I grew up. So I'm taking care of former teachers and their kids and former classmates. And it really has built this rewarding lifestyle where I'm seeing the same people multiple times a year. And that continuity of care is priceless to me.
Ah, that's wonderful. Well, my son is one of the kids who has a peanut and tree nut allergy. And he also had some weird allergies like salmon and things when he was a little kid. And I had to really advocate with my healthcare providers to get him tested. I felt that they really pushed back on me and said this was normal. He was sure maybe has a little reflux, things like that. And in our case, it was accurate. He did have those allergies. What should people who suspect that their child or someone in their life has an allergy, what are the real nudges that mean they should go in and get more substantial testing?
Right. So if we're talking about babies, if they have severe eczema, that's a skin condition that can predispose you to food allergies, we may want to get you tested ahead of time before you're really introducing highly allergenic foods. Mainly peanut is the one that we worry about the most. Or if they already have an egg allergy, we often will test them for peanut allergy. But let's say you're eating food and you notice consistently that I eat this one particular food and I develop itching or hives or swelling or any kind of problem breathing or vomiting. It's that reproducibility of those severe, almost immediate reactions that get me concerned, where we should definitely test. I do caution people that when we do panel testing, it may end up giving you more allergies than you think you do. And so that could cause a false positive test. And then you're stuck with a label that's hard to get off. And so I always say, let's look at the story, look at what's happened, and then see if it's happened multiple times and test towards that first. And then take that out before we start adding a bunch of other foods. Otherwise, we're going to cause more harm than help in certain situations.
And I guess my final question before we wrap up would be, is it possible to just outgrow allergies? Because anecdotally in our life, our young son has outgrown them quite a bit. But what is the general wisdom about that?
I'm really glad to hear that because it can be difficult to know whether or not you do outgrow them. And some foods, yes, some foods, no. So if it's cow's milk, egg, wheat, as an example, those are more likely to be outgrown than something like peanuts, tree nuts, or seafood. So it really depends. If you develop the allergy as an adult, which about half of adults with food allergies develop it later in life, that's usually more persistent. And it's hard to figure out who's more at risk for it being persistent or not outside of the food itself. And so we have to regularly check with an allergist and get tested on a routine basis to figure out, based on the antibody levels, is this somebody who might be able to benefit from trying this in our clinic, what we call an oral food challenge.
Very briefly, what would cause you to develop an allergy later in life from a food or something you've been exposed to and had no issues with up until that point?
It's very hard for us. We're still trying to figure out exactly, but I will say the one that makes the most sense in terms of a hypothesis is for shellfish allergies, the protein structures do have some similarities to dust mites. So if you have a dust mite allergy, your immune system over time may get confused and start reacting to shellfish.
Wow. Well, I've seen pictures of those dust mites, and they are creepy little...
Oh, yeah.
Cephalopod type creatures. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. We've been talking with allergist Dr. Zachary Rubin. He has a new book out called All About Allergies that just came out a couple weeks ago. And you can find him all over social media in really cool, pithy little bits of allergenic wisdom and knowledge and updates. So thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Rubin.
Thank you for having me.